Today in Studio 360.
Can you hear me or what?
I'll talk with the artist Ralph Steadman.
Oh, dear.
His career as an illustrator took off in 1970 with one of the weirdest job offers ever.
How'd you like to go to Kentucky and meet an ex-Hell's Angel who just shaved his head?
I'll talk with Steadman about his years working with Hunter S. Thompson and watch helplessly as he splatters ink all over my studio. Mr. Steadman is now flicking his hand.
Oh, God. Oh, well.
I'll also talk with one of the impressive kids who's entered our summer poetry challenge. Her poem was inspired by a summer pop hit from a couple of years ago.
We scream it when we hear it and act madly, as though we haven't heard it a million times before. This song is overplayed, overrated, overbought.
That's all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. When I think of the images that define the counterculture of the late 1960s and early 70s, right up there with the photos of Jimi Hendrix playing Woodstock are those addled-looking pen and ink illustrations by Ralph Steadman. I'll talk with Steadman later this hour, along with one of today's influential young author illustrators, Sean Tan. But to start the show today, the people behind a terrific new 8-episode TV drama premiering this week knew they were working with timely material, but they couldn't have imagined how timely it had turned out to be. The Honorable Woman on the Sundance Channel is a mystery thriller set in London, but all about the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians in the occupied territories, especially Gaza. Maggie Gyllenhaal plays Nessa Stein, a British-Israeli heiress and businesswoman who believes her company can help foster Palestinian-Israeli reconciliation.
Amongst the greatest threats to Israel is Palestinian poverty. Terror thrives in poverty. It dies in wealth. And so we decided that instead of mines, we would lay cables for telephones, for the internet, millions of miles of communication. Because we believe that the strongest wall we can help Israel to maintain is the one through which equality of opportunity can pass.
The writer and producer and director of The Honorable Woman is Hugo Blick, and he is here with me now. Mr. Blick, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So, would you describe Maggie Gyllenhaal's character, Nessa Stein, who she is and what's driving her?
Oh, well, that's a big question for the first one to go. Start with the easy ones. Nessa Stein is the daughter of a Zionist arms procurer, a man who felt his best way of protecting Israel was for his company to provide arms. He was then assassinated in front of his daughter and his son when they were children. And many years later, Nessa inherits the company, but decides, though still a staunch supporter of Israel, that the best contribution that she can make to Israel's security, as it were, is in terms of economics. But it's all very well that Nessa Stein makes that statement, as she does in the first episode. It's altogether a different thing to see her pursue what that actually means to her and how much harder that journey is. So in some ways, she's an allegory of a certain kind of persona within the Jewish Israeli experience.
And you depict, as the series goes on, the nightmarish violence and complexity and seeming intractability of the conflict. But in the end, the show, is, in my view, does not ultimately take a side. Did you begin with that as a guiding principle?
Yes, but I think it would have been enovating on the project if at every point we were rebalancing every...
Yes.
You know, so that everybody went, it could be this, it could be that. I think more interestingly, it was a project that had a moving target of ideas. So it asks you to take this position or recognize this position within the characters. And then later on, maybe at some distance, it'll reinvert a new idea that might make you question the position you took with the character previously.
Well, and the war in Gaza began days after the show began airing on the BBC in the UK and starts in the United States now. As that happened, as events conspired to make this show so relevant and timely to the present moment, what were your feelings about that?
At that moment, when you see the real life issues surrounding real people on both sides of that story, then of course you have to step back and say ours is just a fiction. But then also believing that our fiction has something to illuminate on why this conflict is cyclical. When I was writing the project, I was in Hebron a year ago. It was relatively peaceful. But of course, so peaceful, in fact, that people may think that the problem almost had gone away. And of course, it doesn't go away and it comes back. And I think our story is explaining and exploring that. And for that, I think it has real value.
Now, American public opinion, obviously, is much more pro-Israel than British public opinion, I think it's fair to say. Are Brits and the Americans who've seen this show responding differently to it?
I'll be honest with you. I've been particularly pleased to see when American commentary, how very considered that viewpoint has been. There's a tendency in the UK to review projects like this on a piecemeal basis, episode by episode. There's some value in this because the story changes as it evolves. But I think in terms of the politics, it's been really interesting to notice just how considered the viewpoints have been on your critical fraternity because they've engaged in the entire story. And I think a story like this really does need to be engaged from its beginning and to its end. It is trying to take an overall balanced view that is, in a strange way, pro the existence of both sides. We all recognize, and I certainly recognize, that within Hamas, that is an internationally recognized terrorist organization. But we also recognize that Fatah needs to work with Hamas to a degree, and Israel is extremely nervous about how Hamas are going to involve themselves in a Palestinian future. But I think that commentators have recognized that the need on both sides to recognize the other side's existence is the thing which drives the politics of this story.
Hugo Blick, thank you very much for talking to us today.
It's a great pleasure.
Hugo Blick is the writer, producer, and director of The Honorable Woman, an 8-part series that premiered this week on the Sundance Channel. So, those of you who've seen the first episode of The Honorable Woman, what do you think so far? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
Do not go gentle into that good night.
That sounds like poetry. Poems don't always have to rhyme, you know. They're just supposed to be creative.
All summer, Studio 360 has been taking entries from high school students around the country to our summer poetry challenge. Rhyme, free verse, spoken word, found Twitter poetry, whatever you choose, as long as it's somehow about summer. We'll be announcing the winner on the show right around the beginning of the new school year. We have received more than 200 entries so far, and you've still got a couple of weeks to join in. Right now, I've got one of the entrants on the line, Magdalena, aged 14, who lives in New Mexico. Hi, Magdalena. Welcome to Studio 360.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Would you read us your poem, The Song?
Yes, The Song. We scream it when we hear it and act madly, as though we haven't heard it a million times before. This song is overplayed, overrated, overbought. It's a song that we will soon roll our eyes at, slip over, forget. But a song that we, for now, love. Wear our anthem to be, praise like a child, because it's a song that rhymes with wasted days and ice cream and summer.
That is a terrific poem and also shows a beyond your years kind of knowledge of how the culture industry is marketing music to you. Did you have a particular big summer pop song in mind as you were writing that?
I remember in 2011, just that one song that was like huge, and I don't know if I can say it.
Go ahead.
Call Me Maybe.
Uh-huh.
That was played over and over.
Right.
And I think every summer we have some sort of song like that.
Do you have a favorite poet?
Right now, I'm really loving Charles Simic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I picked up his book the other day, and he writes kind of free verse stuff, and it's really amazing.
That's a good model to have. And either by him or somebody else, do you have a favorite poem?
I think this is kind of, I don't know, a cliche, but I love Robert Frost's Into the Woods, I think that's
uh-huh.
what it is.
Whose Woods These Are, I Think I Know?
Yes.
Well, Charles Simic, Robert Frost, you should, that's a great range. You're on the right track, it sounds like. Magdalena, thank you very much for your poems, and maybe we'll be talking to you again.
That would be great.
There is still time for high school students to enter our Summer Poetry Challenge. The deadline's August 18th. You can find out all the details at studio360.org.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for.
Coming up, I was really eager to meet and talk with Ralph Steadman. But my God, I was not expecting he'd make such a mess.
Oh, it's Happy Vandalism
Day.
Exactly.
That's later in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. When you travel, one of the things you notice is the differences in how people deal with personal space. Generally, in America, where there's 7 acres for each of us, I just calculated, we like our boundaries. You have your space, I have mine, let's keep it that way. We take it for granted, but the photographer Richard Rinaldi found himself fascinated by that invisible bubble of personal space. And he has spent years trying to burst the bubble, getting strangers to hug or hold hands, and then photographing them. An exhibit of those images is touring the country, and they've also been published in a book called Touching Strangers. Sarah Reynolds went to find out what this is all about.
There are very few times when we intentionally touch people we don't know. A handshake when we meet, hand-holding in church, maybe. We don't really touch strangers, unless maybe someone asks us to.
I remember it was a Saturday. I'd forgotten to do something at work.
It was 3 years ago. Jessica Ong was reading on the train, heading home to Queens. She's in her early 30s, slender frame, laughs easily, and that day she was stopped on the train by photographer Richard Rinaldi.
In the subway, you gotta work fast, because people are like, they're on their way somewhere, and eventually their stop's gonna come up. Jessica got on, and I thought she was really lovely.
I mean, being a native New Yorker, I don't notice. Like, I'm very good at tuning things out. So I don't think I noticed his humongous camera.
I would say basically I'm making family portraits out of strangers.
Richard asked Jessica if he could take her picture. He introduced her to a middle-aged guy with a denim jacket, shoulder-length wavy hair. His name was Alfredo, another stranger. Richard asked them to embrace, to face the camera. And then he took that picture with his big 8x10 view camera. It's square with an accordion lens on the front, like something from the 19th century. In the photograph, their upper bodies touch. Alfredo's arm drapes around Jessica's shoulder. He leans away from her, slightly, as if he wants to be both close and not too close. They stand on either side of the metal subway pole and hold hands like old friends. And when the photo was done, they all parted ways. Richard did this about 170 times over the course of 7 years, in Baltimore and New Orleans, New Bedford, Massachusetts, Las Vegas. Not everyone said yes, but many did, and maybe more than you'd think, considering that touching a stranger can be kind of a weird thing.
I was very fearful about doing it. So the very first one I did, in retrospect, I think it was so tentative, because I was so tentative. And I think it has made me a more fearless and better photographer.
In his photographs, there's a warmth, a familiarity between these touching strangers, or at least you think there is. So you're left wondering, are we imagining the kindness between them? Are they faking it? Or can sharing a few awkward minutes actually make two strangers care about each other?
We were just eating funnel cake right before that picture was taken. I was sitting with my two little brothers and my mother at the time. And he just walks up to me. He said, "Would you like to be in a picture?"
Jeremy Coleman was at the Ohio State Fair with his family when he met Rinaldi. He's 24 and shy.
And I'm usually not that comfortable with a stranger, so that's what kind of like took me for a loop. I surprised myself.
He'd just come from a Kesha concert. The other stranger in the photo, Matthew, looks like he'd just come from the rodeo. Matthew is white, stocky, with a cowboy hat, t-shirt, and jeans. And Jeremy's black, short hair and glasses. Matthew sits at a picnic table in the photo, and Jeremy stands behind him with his hand on his shoulder.
It almost looks like we know each other in a weird sort of way.
Jeremy and Matthew are posed in front of the American flag hanging on a wall, both stoic, like they've soldiered through something together. The photo surprises you, the way it juxtaposes race and body type and their sense of style. With the flag behind them, it feels like a larger story about our society, about how divided we still are. It's as if the photo is saying, look at the intimacy, and yet all we see are the differences. Elaine Hargrove pulls a box from a high shelf in her bedroom to show me the photo Richard took of her. She was walking to a job interview when he spotted her.
I kind of could chalk it up to, like, subway moments, the way the subways kind of mix and mingle and mash people together. But also weird things happen that kind of make people bond very quickly sometimes, or find allies, or, you know, whether it's, like, somebody vomits on the train or falls, or there can be, like, really quick bonds fused. I appreciate that.
You look like you know each other. It looks like a very familial photo.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, like, strike a chord that I say that, or?
No, I think we were both pretty comfortable with it. Like, maybe we're both just, you know, kind of crunchy and, like, okay being close to people.
In the photo, Elaine's embracing a woman twice her age, maybe in her 60s. And their hug, it's so close, it looks like Richard interrupted something to take the shot. Her companion leans into her. Elaine holds her to her chest as if she's providing solace.
She looks very, like, troubled or forlorn in the photo. Looks like you're comforting her.
I can't help investing the scene with an emotion that just wasn't there. There was one man who emailed me but didn't want to talk. In the picture, he's kneeling on a basketball court, a middle-aged man wearing a winter hat and sweatpants. An elderly woman stands next to him, their height matched. Their hands are clasped, each finger crossed through the other. It looks like he's asking for forgiveness. Here's what he wrote.
Through 20 long years in New York City, I had not one picture of me with anyone. So when I was approached to take one beautiful picture, I did. Not with a stranger, but with a woman that spent 80 some odd years on this earth. She was no stranger to me.
But I see this intimacy in almost all the photos, even if it is a mirage. Richard himself calls these pairings fictional and orchestrated. They are, after all, strangers. Teju Cole, the photographer and author who wrote the foreword to Richard's book, says this.
A photograph is nothing but surface. But there are ineffable truths in the way things look. How things seem can be more startling than how they are.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Reynolds.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wondering in the night, what were the chances we'd be sharing love?
We have a slideshow of Richard Rinaldi's photographs up at studio360.org.
I am living a normal life. Meanwhile, this, right alongside me, this myth is growing and mushrooming and getting more and more warped. And when I get invited to speak at, say, universities, I'm not sure if they're inviting Duke or Thompson.
Very few people have left as large a mark on journalism of the last half century as Hunter S. Thompson. Subjective, provocative, funny, altogether rogue. Thompson's writing about America around 1970 is one of the best records we've got of that time. But Hunter Thompson wouldn't be Hunter Thompson without the artist Ralph Steadman, who illustrated his most famous articles. Steadman's style is instantly recognizable. His pictures are splattered with ink. His people are twisted and contorted. His line is violent. Nobody has depicted ugliness as beautifully as Ralph Steadman. And he's the subject of a new documentary called For No Good Reason. And he is also here with me now, Ralph Steadman. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Kurt.
So you're this unknown artist from England, and in 1970 you come to America without much of a plan, and you're immediately sent out on assignment with this guy who winds up changing your life, Hunter S. Thompson.
Hunter S. Thompson. He was described to me as, how'd you like to go to Kentucky and meet an ex-Hells Angel who just shaved his head?
And did you immediately hit it off with Hunter Thompson, or was...
Well, we were 3 days looking for each other, and they told Hunter... They said, yeah, he's a bit weird. He's a real weird one. You won't miss him when you see him, you know. So we were looking for each other for 3 days. We eventually did find each other. Excuse me. I heard a voice behind me. So I turned around. And suddenly, this six-foot-tall guy, bullet head, you know, shaved. And he said, hello, are you Ralph Steadman? I said, yes, I am. I'm Hunter Thompson, you know. So... He suddenly said, well, they said you were weird, but not that weird.
Hunter Thompson's style of journalism was to make himself the center of what he was writing about.
The phrase is that you do not go to cover a story ostensibly, but in fact, you don't cover a story, you become the story.
Yes.
That's the thing.
And he certainly did that. Did you feel as though you were obliged to do something analogous to that as you were accompanying
him? Well, I was curious enough to think, well, maybe I'll be part of this thing. You know, if you're going to do this, we may as well do it together. The Wittgenstein phrase is the only thing of value is the thing you cannot say. But if I can see it, that's far more sort of... graphic, isn't it?
Right.
More interesting.
So that's what you were out to do.
I guess that's what I was out to do, yeah.
You obviously, as this documentary makes clear, had a very close relationship with Hunter, but it was also obviously fraught and sometimes even abusive. Why did you put up with it?
It was funny abusive, really.
Yeah.
You know, I just said I likened myself to his pet minor bird.
Right.
Edward. Edward, there is no bird god I know. That's going to save you now, Edward. I'm going to kill you, Edward. Uh-huh. You know, and he would grab the bird, pull it out of the cage, which would be squawking and pecking and like crazy at him. So it was a kind of a, there's a sort of a fond torture going on with Hunter
sort
and
of a
his victims.
Mutt and Jeff.
And Jeff type of thing.
Yeah. When people met you and when people meet you once you guys were sort of well-known, did they expect you to be gnarly and dark and vicious and theatrical like Hunter?
A lot of people said, you must be quite an unpleasant person, you see. And they expected me to be unpleasant when they met him. Yeah. I said, oh, no, all that goes down on paper. You know, get it out of your system. Don't harbor aggressive thoughts. Get them out.
At one point in the documentary, you say to Hunter Thompson that it was your illustrations that made Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas noticed and iconic. And he's not entirely buying that. Do you think that?
Of course.
Do you still think that?
Well, it's like this thing about seeing, you know, and saying. It's more memorable when you've got something to sort of refer to. It's like a symbol, iconic symbol. The drawings became.
Yeah.
And so people think of that, and then they can read the book again and enjoy the book because the words are wonderful.
Right.
And so...
It's a compressed way of keeping in their heads.
It wasn't a denigration in any way of Hunter and his words. It was just saying that I think it's the trademark, if you like, put it like that.
100%. When he killed himself 9 years ago at age 67, did it strike you as inevitable?
Yeah, well, he told me early on, said, Ralph, I feel real trapped in this life. I didn't know I could commit suicide at any moment. And he had 23 fully loaded guns at Owl Farm.
In Aspen.
Aspen, yeah, Owl Farm Aspen, yes. And I knew that one day he would do it. And as that, you know, that phrase, I always knew that one day I would make this journey, but I did not know yesterday that it would be today, you know. And it came rather unexpectedly on February 20th, 2005. It was sort of, well, it was a shock still.
Yeah.
And I thought, God damn stupid thing. And, you know, in the kitchen at Owl Farm, the bullet hole is still through the cooker hood, and he was on the phone to his wife, who was at the health club, can you imagine? And then it was Bob Browdis, the sheriff of Aspen at the time, Pitkin County sheriff, who called all the 24 other Pitkin County sheriffs, and they all arrived at Owl Farm and all took a book down, stood around Hunter's body and read a page in respect or out of respect.
From his work. Wow, which is I'd never heard that.
Now, that's interesting. So that was a lovely... It's funny what people do when there's that sense of occasion.
Yeah. Before you ever met Hunter Thompson, when you were a kid in the 50s, 40s, how did you learn to draw?
Well, I wasn't drawing then. Not really. No, I didn't start that. I wanted to be... I was building model airplanes, you know. And then I got an apprenticeship at de Havilland Aircraft Company. And I was design technical drawings and things like that. And I was doing little scribbles in the border. But I hadn't really made any positive idea, a decision to become an artist. But I saw this advert which said in some newspaper somewhere, you too can learn to draw and earn pounds. Take the Percy V. Bradshaw Press Art School course for 12 lessons in how to draw. See? So you can learn to draw in 12 lessons. So I took the course while I was doing military service. But I didn't really get into drawing properly until I came down to London immediately after military service. But I was offered a job in an editorial office as the cartoonist who would do cartoons daily.
And these were political cartoons?
No, these were, general social type of thing. The first cartoon I had published was in the Manchester Evening Chronicle, and there was the Suez Canal crisis at the time.
56.
NASA, that's it. That was the one. And my first cartoon, it was of a lockkeeper sitting there reading the paper, and it's talking about the Suez Canal, and he's saying, NASA, who's he, you see?
Uh-huh. When and why did splattering ink become an important part of
clumsiness.
Really?
Yeah, I thought, oh God.
And it wasn't some Jackson Pollock thing you were trying to...
Oh, no, I wasn't doing that. No, not really, no. That was something... Well, that was so positively... That was dripping. I wasn't splatting.
Yeah, right.
You know, there was dribbling and stuff around. Yeah. You know, there was a messy bucket.
So really, you made a mistake and decided, let that go.
Like that and go, you know. There's a flick of... There's a certain flick.
Yeah.
And that's the flick. But you see, you can't see that on radio.
Yes.
You may be able to.
Mr. Stedman is now flicking his hand. I understand you have some materials here today, and I would love it if you could draw and we can watch and
I'll draw. Well, I'm making an attempt to draw Kurt here. Oh, you've got some hair, though. You have got good hair.
That's what they say.
Listen, this is really something.
I look like a pig now.
Yeah, I know. It's unfortunate, but... Oh, God. No, look, you made me do.
I made you spill more ink.
Oh, God. Oh, well.
Ralph Stedman.
Oh, that's a pleasure.
It was a total pleasure, and I have never been so happy at an act of vandalism in my life. Yes.
Oh, it's Happy Vandalism Day today, isn't it?
For No Good Reason is the new documentary about Ralph Stedman. It comes out on DVD in September. You can see his drawings of me and a video of him in action flicking ink all over the studio at studio360.org. You're listening to Studio 360, and this is Kurt Anderson. Sean Tan is an award-winning, best-selling illustrator whose
odd and beautiful and moving stories are populated by singular creatures and landscapes that fuse the natural with the retro-mechanical. One of his books, The Lost Thing, follows a boy who comes across a big, strange, sweet creature on the beach. A curious thing that doesn't seem to belong anywhere in the boy's dull, dystopian world.
I have a lost thing.
I call for the receptionist.
Fill in the forms.
She sighed.
The Lost Thing was turned into a short film that won the Oscar for animated shorts 3 years ago.
I was looking around for a desk. I suddenly felt something touch my elbow. And then there was a tiny voice.
Sean Tan's books are not easily pigeonholed. In some bookstores, you'll find them in the children's section. In others, they're shelved with graphic novels. His latest book is called The Rules of Summer, and here we are deep in summer. So, Sean Tan, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, great to be on it.
So, you have said that most children draw, but eventually most of them stop doing it. How come you didn't ever stop?
Oh, that's a good question. I grew up in Perth in Western Australia, and that's a very remote place, and I was in a remote part of that city. So in some ways, I had nothing else to do. So I just spent a lot of time as a child drawing and painting, and it kind of ambled along uninterrupted and finally got to the end of university arts degree and realized I wasn't qualified to do anything. So I decided to become a freelance illustrator because I like drawing.
Yep.
And eventually found my feet in children's publishing of all places, which is not something I'd set my sights on. And that sort of led me to where I am now.
You've said that you discovered the Twilight Zone at age 11, and that was an important moment.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting to me because, of course, when you were 11, the Twilight Zone was already this old antique thing. And I wondered, is that why so much of your work seems to be in this vaguely grim mid-century black and whitish world?
That's an interesting question. I never really thought about it. You know, as a kid, you don't think of things in terms of, you know, temporal spectrum. It's all coming at you at once. And, you know, I would set my video player at home to record these obscure late night episodes of The Twilight Zone, a show nobody else seemed to be watching except me. And I just saw it all as contemporary.
Huh.
I don't know how that actually filters into my work, except that I do have a great trust for old things, partly because they've endured, much like life forms, you know, and nature.
Uh-huh.
You can trust it. I don't have much trust for things that are happening now. You know, I'll never paint an illustration with a picture of an iPhone or something in it because
right.
That's just going to become irrelevant in 10 years' time.
Well, it's interesting because in your work, there are so many drawings of old, dusty, papery-seeming things. You clearly do, I won't say fetishize, but you love old things and want to depict either old things or things that can't be placed in any particular time.
I think it's also I'm interested in things that are forgotten, and that fascinates me. I think that one of the big characteristics of being a human being is amnesia. In the broad scheme of things, a lot of the most interesting things in the world are overlooked or forgotten, or, you know, they pass into disuse. I'm fascinated by those. I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, the objects that appear on roadside collections once upon a time were so loved and fresh and new and cherished, and now they're just junk. And I think that's a process that's happening constantly, and I think there's a lot to be mined from that in terms of understanding the spirit of our time.
Do you think of your books as children's books, as books for everybody? For whom?
I used to think that a lot of my books were not children's book, and I would protest loudly against anybody who would categorize them as children's book. I'd be, no, they're not children's books. They're for adults. They're for everybody. And then I found out that there were these, like, you know, 7 or 8 year olds just making these remarkable comments about the illustrations and understanding some of the books at a very deep level. And I understood that maybe I need to learn more from the way kids view things than think in terms of categories and
right.
just sort of regard children as people. And so I kind of stopped thinking about this question or worrying about it. And I just focus on what feels right to me and trust
right.
that that children will also identify with something.
All of your books that I've seen have similar elements. You can see that a given author, artist has done these. They're highly evocative. They have whimsical characters. They have these big, sometimes strange landscapes. But the drawing style changes quite a bit from book to book. Do you seek to create a distinct world for each story?
Yes, I do, but I don't set out with that ambition. It just sort of happens. Almost every book starts out looking the same style. But then as the idea develops and I start to think about what is the story really about in terms of its spirit, the style just adapts. So, for instance, with The Arrival, I realized that story was about real people. It took me a long time to realize that because it's set in a strange fantasy world about a man going to a fictitious country. But because it was based on real migrant stories, I eventually came back to biting the bullet and drawing every single panel photorealistically, which is a very painful thing to do. But I knew it had to be done.
You start with a ballpoint pen and you love the old. Does that mean everything you exclusively do hand work, or do you ever use digital tools?
I do use digital tools. That said, I don't really trust digital tools at the level of the creative crucible. So I do paint everything by hand. And there's things that happen when you're working with physical materials that are very difficult to simulate digitally, and that is the way paint drips, runs, mixes incorrectly on the palette, and triggers new ideas.
The film of The Lost Thing, however, of course, was made digitally, although it endeavors beautifully to look handmade. As you made the deal for that film to happen, were you insistent that it not just be another shiny digital animation?
Oh, definitely. And we had the advantage that working on that film, we were a very small team. All the visuals you see on the screen are produced by three people. And we were all quite keen to avoid what's now become a slightly numbing style for us as people who watch a lot of these films. And that is, we can't distinguish stylistically between different animated films because they're largely using not just the same software but the same kind of stylistic solutions in terms of lighting and depth and translucency and so on. And so we really wanted to have something that was almost uncontrolled. And the way we did that was by me going back and painting by hand on scraps of paper and cloth this huge library of textures, which then became the palette, which was wrapped around the digital models. And the moment we did that, they stopped looking like pieces of beautifully illuminated plastic and started looking really grungy and a little bit strange. And then we knew we were on the right track.
Your new book, The Rules of Summer, which I like very much, follows the adventures of two boys. Each page has a rule like never lose a fight, and then an illustration that accompanies it, does not necessarily in a conventional way illustrate it. Can you describe the illustration that goes with never lose a fight?
Yes, never lose a fight. Okay, it's a wintry landscape. In the distance is a kind of derelict train station with a sort of simplified locomotive, almost like a fossilized locomotive, belching smoke, glowing some infernal red light from inside. And in the foreground is a group of crows, a murder of crows gathered around two boys. One of the boys is tied up, like completely tied up. He can't move his arms. He can't walk. There's just a long cord leading from him to the hand of his brother. And his brother is somewhat distracted by a crow that's handing him a golden crown. And at first it's kind of difficult to understand what's going on, but it seems to be some sort of transaction that's rather sinister. If you see it in the context of the book, everything that's led up to this point makes sense, that the two brothers have had a falling out and the older one decides to sell the younger one for this thing, whatever it is, a kind of symbol of authority.
You have a brother. Was any of this book inspired by your relationship with your brother?
Definitely, although the book was published almost the same time as his birthday, and I sent a copy to him and I had to write in the front, this is not autobiographical, don't be offended by it, because the older brother is somewhat mean in this story. I actually created the book for myself entirely from the point of view of the younger brother. Like, I strongly identify with this somewhat pathetic victim.
Yes.
But it's very interesting when I've given the book to people, both adults and children, who are older siblings, and they see it from the older brother's point of view.
And often
it brings up issues of guilt about how they were a little bit mean to their younger sibling. And so that's very interesting because I never saw it from that point of view myself.
Yeah. The story is clear as one reads it, but it is so economically told by means of these rules. And there is so much narrative space between the picture and the text that the reader has to imagine and fill in because so much is unsaid. The way you accompany this dire image with this very chirpy rules for summer is very funny. I think you've hit on, I mean, it's sort of Edward Gorey-esque.
Yes, yeah, Edward Gorey is the master of that extreme understatement. And also many picture book illustrators actually, where there are actually great big gaps between what you're reading and what you're seeing. And in between, the reader is invited to invest their own narrative and particularly emotional response. So I do have my own interpretations of each picture, my own narrative of what's going on, but I deliberately withhold those to allow the reader to come up with their own.
So you make books, some of which are for children. Do you have children?
Yes, I do now. I have a 10-month-old daughter.
Uh-huh.
I suddenly realized what picture books are used for. It never occurred to me that parents sit down with their kids and go through and examine the pictures. And I thought, well, my books are pretty good for that, actually, you know, because I don't really tell the story. I give the parents an extreme amount of license to interpret it with their child. And she hasn't actually seen any of my books yet because I think they're a little bit weird.
Yes.
And a little dark for her, but I'm really looking forward to introducing them to her. And I'm not going to say that I did them. We're just going to talk about them as if they're, you know, foreign artifact that's just been brought into the house and see what her interpretations are.
I'll be interested to see how that works out on Daddy's feelings if she hates them. But when will she be old enough? 3? 4?
Oh, I don't know. You know, it'd just be interesting to see how she responds to colors and shapes, you know, whether she can recognize a really good composition or not.
Sean Tan, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Sean Tan's new book, The Rules of Summer, is out now. You can see a slideshow of some of his work at studio360.org. I really enjoyed talking with Sean, and there's a much longer version of our conversation up on our website as well. On this show, I often ask writers and artists about the films or books that changed the trajectories of their lives. Today, we hear from the journalist Ron Suskind. He won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism in 1995, and he's written many books on politics, including The 1% Doctrine, The Way of the World, and Confidence Men. Suskind is married and has 2 sons, Walter and Owen. And many years ago, when Owen was just 3, Ron and his wife began to notice that his behavior started to change. He just seemed off.
And over about 3 months, he loses all speech. And at that point, we realized something had gone terribly wrong.
After seeing several doctors, Owen was diagnosed with autism.
This is regressive autism, as some specialists explain. He may never get his speech back. Some don't. You know, the idea that our son, who just a few months ago was chatting away, you know, mom and dad and where are my toys and when are we going to the park, was Raymond Babbitt from Rain Man. So, you know, we just kind of froze. He, at that point, stops speaking. He doesn't make eye contact. He seems lost and unreachable. You feel a change of life. Your ears and eyes are working, but your heartbeat, I don't know what happens to it. The one thing he was doing, he loved sitting and watching the Disney animated movies. He would sit up in our bedroom in Georgetown and watch The Little Mermaid.
Part of your world.
Beauty and the Beast.
You'll be our guest, we our guest, be our guest.
And The Lion King.
Just can't wait to be king.
It seemed to be the only thing he wanted to do. Now, we have an older son, Walter, tough kid, very independent, as are siblings of disabled folks generally. You know, junior adult already at 9 years old. Owen is 6 and a half at that point. Well, on a particular day, his 9th birthday, Walt gets a little emotional. We're bringing in the cups and plates from the birthday party. We're in the kitchen. Owen follows us in from the backyard, looks at us intently, and says, "Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan." This is his first full sentence, and we just are stunned. And Cornelia and I can't stop talking for the next 4 hours. The question is, how do we get back in? It's like a window opened up. So that night, I go up to his bedroom, and I get the idea that, well, maybe voices will be important here. And I grab the puppet, Iago, who's the sidekick of the evil Jafar, the villain from Aladdin.
Boy, Jafar's going to be happy to see you.
Excellent work, Iago.
Go on.
I slip in and crawl along the rug and then push the puppet up through the crease in the bedspread. And I talk to him as Iago.
So I say to him, "How does it feel to be you, Owen?"
And he turns to the puppet and says, "Not good. I am lonely and I have no friends." And we begin to talk, Iago and Owen. I think, what would Iago say next? Stay in character. And so I say, "So when did you and I become such good friends?" And he said, "When I watched Aladdin, you made me laugh." Then I hear Owen go, like he's clearing his throat. And he's only 6 and a half, so it's more like up here. And then he says, I love the way your foul little mind works. So then we talk as Jafar to Iago. This is our first conversation. And then it dawns on me, and of course a minute later when I run downstairs to Cornelia, that if we speak in Disney dialogue, if we throw him a line, I bet he'll throw back the next one. At that point, we begin what we call the basement sessions. So we go to the basement, and we start playing out scenes. Each of us takes a character, let's say for Jungle Book, which is our first basement session. Now, Owen is Mowgli. Walter ends up being King Louie, the orangutan, who is telling Mowgli, "Tell me the secret of man's red fire." Mowgli says, "I don't know how to make fire." Owen sells it. The emotion that the characters feel, he seems to be feeling. And so we send the emotion that our characters are feeling back to him, and he responds. You know, Owen has a really tough life ahead. Any bit of sunshine is something we're going to bask in. And we say we're going to go into the underground cavern of all these Disney movies and just enjoy it. Just do what he does. So he dances in front of the screens and we dance in front of the screen. So he's doing the voices, we're all doing the voices. We're singing the songs.
I want to be like you.
And it created a double life, this, for everyone in the family. You know, I go to work every day. Walt goes to school like any kid. And at night, we become animated characters. In the next several years, you could see how he was finding limited social engagement. He would do voices. Other kids would respond to it. So he goes through his teen years, and he ends up at a college program for folks on the autism spectrum. And first thing he does when he gets there is he starts Disney Club. Because as he says, "I want to meet people like me and have friends and find answers." In the spring of his first year, we drive the hour down to our first Disney Club. And all of a sudden, we look around the room and there are 12 kids just like him. So a particular girl in Disney Club named Emily is a Dumbo person.
"Look, Dumbo, I'm your friend. Come on out."
This now is Owen's girlfriend. All he needed to hear was she was a Dumbo person, and off they went. They've been dating for about 2 years now. These are all drawn. Disney, just like the Brothers Grimm, draw these from folklore. these myths are not kids' stuff. They're the stories we've been telling ourselves for thousands of years to make our way in the world. We make sense of ourselves through story. We've always done that. It's part of the human capacity.
This year, Ron Suskind published a book about his experiences with his son Owen called Life Animated. Our story was produced by Andres O'Hara Plotnick. How about you? Has some movie or book or any other piece of art ever changed your life? We'd like to hear about it. Leave us a message at studio360.org. And now we are done with this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. You can keep up with us every day on Twitter at Studio 360 Show and at Sideshow. And a final note to you high school writers, be sure to send us your poetry on the theme of summer. The deadline is coming up very soon, Monday, August 18th at midnight. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramasvaram,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Shruti Pinnamaneni,
Ariel Roland Waring,
Marshall Bright,
Hannah Alonji.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Rufus Wainwright sings about his struggles with drugs and love and family, but he says music cannot solve your problems.
Artistry and poetry will not save your life. I mean, there's a point when you have to kind of get off the trolley ride and, you know, go see a therapist.
Rufus Wainwright is next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.